This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The euro is saved, or maybe it's not. The UN tackles climate change again, and the real costs of that iPhone you're holding. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses and the computer files they depend on. Learn more and receive a free trial at Carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 28th of November. Good to have you with us. And don't look now, but the European crisis is fixed. All right, that's not entirely true, but you'd never know it to judge by the markets. Investors bet big today that the 17 countries that use the euro are edging towards something that's going to put their debt crisis right. The phrase on everybody's lips today is fiscal union, which means what? From the Marketplace European Desk in London, Stephen Beard explains.
Europe has been in crisis for 2 years. Some economists say the 17-nation currency bloc could soon collapse. Now you would think would be the time to unveil a grand plan. But James Goundry of IHS Global Insight says what's under discussion is rather modest.
Sort of slightly more coordination and supervision of national economic policies within the eurozone. I think something, a tentative steps towards something like that is more likely.
The German government insists this could work. More centralised monitoring of national budgets and strict limits on national debt could create more investor confidence. Greek journalist Martina Steva says it would be quite an intrusion on each country's right to set its own budget.
Before any spending would happen, the partners would approve of that kind of spending.
Of course, if the eurozone turned itself into a real fiscal union, with all the member states guaranteeing each other's debt, that would stop the crisis in its tracks. But Tim Leunig of the London School of Economics says that's not going to happen.
Germany is not going to want to give huge amounts of money to other people who it sees as feckless. But equally, other people are not going to want to be bossed around by Germany and told what they can and cannot spend their money on.
And that's why the eurozone is only talking about a weaker form of fiscal union. The question is, will it be enough to reassure investors? In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One reason European leaders are talking seriously about forming, if I may here to borrow a phrase, a more perfect union? Money. How little some EU governments have of it and how much they have to pay to borrow more of it. You know, countries borrow money all the time. It's not usually newsworthy stuff. But this week, Italy, Belgium, Spain, and France are going to try to sell more than $20 billion worth of bonds, borrow that much money. We asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith to explain how the markets, and not the politicians, are the ones driving this crisis.
Governments raise money in two ways, taxing us and selling bonds. Raghu Rajan is an economist with the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business.
Governments spend more than they raise in taxes, and the difference is made up by issuing bonds.
Bonds are an IOU from a country. You loan the country money, and it pays you back with interest. Rajan says since government bonds are usually seen as super safe, those interest rates tend to be low. Not the case for Italy right now.
Markets have started questioning whether they have the ability to repay their debt.
It's a lot like what happens when someone who had good credit starts paying bills late. Neil Dutta is an economist at Bank of America.
Well, how's a lender going to respond to that? I mean, a credit card company, for example, would probably cut your credit line. They might not even extend you credit.
To get people to lend it money now, Italy has to pay higher interest rates. Today, Italy sold bonds at more than 7% interest. That's more than three times what the U.S. pays for similar bonds. Italy's interest costs are now so big, they're a tenth of the country's economic output. Again, University of Chicago's Raghu Rajan.
That's huge. That is the kind of payment that we make to the entire Social Security, for example.
Rajan says Italy has to step up with a financial plan that will convince investors it's turning its economy around. Second of all, the European Central Bank and neighboring countries have to back Italy, says economist Neil Dutta.
The ECB, that's ultimately where they'd have to get the money.
Kind of like when you get your parents to guarantee a loan. Dutta thinks eventually the ECB will start buying Italy's bonds.
It's incumbent upon them to not let Italy spiral out of control because, as has been said so truthfully, Italy's not only too big to fail, it's too big to save.
Dutta says the future of the Eurozone hinges on rallying around Italy. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
So let's say the bond markets really get fed up. Push comes to shove, the Eurozone breaks up. They call it quits. What do you suppose that would look like? Something like a real-life divorce, it turns out. Messy for the spouses, and the damage wouldn't stop there. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has that story.
Back in the 90s, there was a best-selling book called The Good Divorce. It was all about achieving orderly, civilized breakups. Well, don't expect that if the Eurozone splits up.
A breakup of the Eurozone would be extremely painful and extremely messy.
Sebastian Malaby is a scholar at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Every single business contract in Europe is denominated in euros, and if you throw that currency out of the window, you're going to have sort of monetary pandemonium.
Pandemonium and loss, says Domenico Lombardi, an economic policy specialist at the Brookings Institution.
Many countries would experience substantial devaluation in their own currencies.
Countries like Greece and Italy, they'd fall back on their old pre-euro currencies and could even face bankruptcy. Sebastian Malaby says like in any divorce, there'd be no real winners. Richer family members like Germany would feel heartache too.
Because, you know, their economic model has been based on exporting to those other European economies, and those exports will take a hit.
And they've lent to all those poorer relatives too.
And all those loans they've been making for the last decade will now not be paid back.
The trouble would extend beyond the family, too. Neighbors would get sucked in, like the U.S., as European banks dump U.S. stocks and bonds to raise money so they can stay afloat. Marriage counselors would call that the damaging ripple effects. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
This is one of those days where you get completely random and, frankly, questionable pseudo-economic indicators like this one about today, Cyber Monday, that businesses are going to lose a combined $1 billion in worker productivity because everybody's shopping online from the office. Ridiculous. Although, I do need a new pair of shoes. Size 10.5. I need brown and black.
Hey, Kai, we have a show to do.
Oh, yeah. Traders were plenty productive on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One would like to think that when a government agency, say the Securities and Exchange Commission, reaches a settlement with an accused wrongdoer, say Citigroup, that settlement gets at and fixes what was done wrong in the first place. Since the financial crisis, the SEC has brought cases against a bunch of big financial firms, saying they misled investors by selling mortgage-backed securities they knew were likely to fail. One such case against, as it happens, Citigroup was settled last month for $285 million. Today it was thrown out because the judge said it wasn't in the public interest, essentially that the SEC wasn't interested in learning what Citigroup did wrong. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura has the story.
The Securities and Exchange Commission has settled cases like this one for decades, and courts usually give them a rubber stamp. That's why today's ruling, handed down by Judge Jed Rakoff, stands out.
The ruling we got today is unusual in general, but not unusual for Judge Rakoff.
That's Edward Rock. He teaches securities law at Penn. He says Rakoff, like a handful of judges, has been uncomfortable with settlements.
The problem with settlements is you don't get a full hearing on the facts. You don't have a determination as to who was at fault, whether somebody violated the law or not.
Judge Rakoff argues the public deserves to know more. The SEC said today that the settlement was reasonable and would lead to changes in the financial industry's behavior without wasting time and money. Jeffrey Manns, a law professor at George Washington University, says the SEC depends on settlements to do its job.
The analogy you should think about is plea bargaining in the criminal context. If every criminal defendant demanded their full constitutional rights to trial by jury, our entire criminal justice system would be swamped.
Mann says today's ruling highlights a long-standing problem with the SEC.
The SEC is outgunned and outmanned. You have an agency of less than 4,000 people called upon to oversee the entire financial sector.
If more judges rule like Judge Rakoff, that may force the SEC to take more cases to trial. That'd be easy for the financial services industry. It can pay top dollar for legal representation, but it'd be much harder for the SEC. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Man, you learn all kinds of things shopping while you're on the company dime. Like, look at this, the online flash sale. Only an hour left, Amazon tells me, to get something called a Barska biometric safe for only $149.99. Save 63%. Gotta have that.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business. Carbonite Business is an online automatic backup solution designed specifically for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically and continually backs up computer files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other computer problem, files can easily be recovered. To learn more about Carbonite Business and to receive a free trial, visit Carbonite.com and use the code Marketplace.
In Egypt, this is election day, a real election for the first time in decades. Lines were long. People waited hours to cast their ballots. It's been a tense couple of weeks with the violence in Tahrir Square over when the military is going to hand over power to a civilian government. But out in the streets of Cairo today, that wasn't top of mind with a lot of voters. Julia Simon reports it was the economy.
It's early morning in Cairo's working-class Shubra neighborhood. 31-year-old housewife Fatma Ali approaches the end of a long line at an elementary school to cast her vote. She says her husband, a plumber, has been out of work for months, and she worries about the future for her two children.
Life is hard here, and there are a lot of people who can't afford to eat.
Ali and her family are among the 40% of all Egyptians who live on less than $2 a day, and there's only one group she'd consider voting for: the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party.
They help us with schools and hospitals, everything we need. They'll make Egypt a better place.
The Freedom and Justice Party is expected to win as much as a third of all seats in parliament. The Muslim Brotherhood is one of the largest and most organized groups in Egypt, and they appeal to poor voters like Fatma Ali through their extensive charitable programs. Abdul Hafiz Asawi wrote the economic platform for the Freedom and Justice Party. He says the group's main aim is to narrow the gap between the rich and poor. In addition to raising the minimum wage, he says the party will
balance the budget, especially in education and health, improve the investment environment, fight corruption, and create jobs.
The Freedom and Justice Party has a broad following. Its ranks are full of doctors, lawyers, and educated professionals. Mohamed El-Harishi is a 20-year-old business student. His dad, a physician, helped run a freedom and justice campaign in Cairo.
What is economics all about? It's about efficiency. So that's what Muslim Brothers have the capabilities, have the potentials to achieve that.
But the Brotherhood worries other voters who fear the group has an Islamic agenda. And for some, it's not clear whether the Freedom and Justice Party will make the economy a priority. Hazem Hosni teaches political science at Cairo University. He says the Muslim Brotherhood knows its charity work is key to its appeal. In many ways, Hosni says, it's better for the group that Egypt stay poor.
Because when Egyptians are poor, they need someone to give them some subsidies, some help. And through these subsidies, they control these elections. They gain elections through these poor people, keep Egyptians in a needy state.
But the Freedom and Justice Party's Asawi says his group is committed to training and job development.
No, we're not just giving a man a fish. We're teaching him to fish.
But that message hasn't convinced butcher Abdul Fattah in the Nawah village north of Cairo. He
He sharpens his knife and cuts a piece of lamb for a customer. Fatah says he'll go to the polls when his district votes in January, but he won't vote for the Freedom and Justice Party. As part of charity efforts last month, the Muslim Brotherhood sold lamb in his village. But they sold it at cheaper prices than Fatah could, and he lost business. In Cairo, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
You want to know where Apple's Chinese factories are? Follow your nose.
The air carries a strong chemical smell like WD-40.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, never mind that there are still 27 shopping days till Christmas. Wall Street heard jingle bells from retailers today. The Dow Industrials dashed ahead 291 points, better than 2.5%. Closed at 11,523. The NASDAQ lurched forward 85 points, 3.5%, 2527 the number. The S&P 500 bounced 33 points, a little shy of 3%, wrapped up trading at 1192. Shares of Macy's rang up nearly 5%. Best Buy lived up to its name. Buyers pumped its stock up by more than 3%. Shares of Nordstrom rose 2.5% today. JCPenney pocketed a gain of almost 1.75%. Bond prices were down even before some late-breaking news from Fitch. The credit rating agency is maintaining Uncle Sam AAA, but shifting its outlook to negative. Yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 1.97%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. In Washington, it's all about less cookies, more carrots. That's a topic on the agenda at a summit on childhood obesity. And he's got true grit in the industry. Coen brother Joel turns 57. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Alliance to Save the Planet reconvenes today in Durban, South Africa. It's the most recent meeting of the United Nations Conference on Climate Change. The last one worth a mention was 2 years ago in Copenhagen, Denmark, where negotiators couldn't agree on how to limit greenhouse gas emissions. It's been about a year and a half since the U.S. Congress couldn't agree on the same thing and gave up trying on a comprehensive energy bill. Which leaves us where exactly? Right now, it leaves us with Marketplace's Scott Tong on the line from our sustainability desk. Hey, Scott.
Hello, Kai.
So I ask this first question with a little bit of trepidation, but what are we expecting out of Durban in this meeting?
Well, here's one word you're not going to be expecting to hear is comprehensive, as we heard in Copenhagen a couple years ago, as in binding carbon caps for everyone.
Right.
The one thing they all agree on is there's no political bandwidth for that, either in big countries like the United States or elsewhere, to overhaul how they drive, how they get power, how they ship things, etc. But in the incremental category, the optimists have a few things they want to do. They want to extend the existing caps for the rich countries that signed on to that Kyoto Protocol in 1997.
These are caps on greenhouse gases, right?
That's right. And as you recall, that's minus the United States. Mm-hmm. And those caps expire next year. They also want to push for a global deal in 2015. That's what the Europeans are marketing. They think that's the earliest they could reasonably come to an agreement. And they want to develop what's called the Green Fund. That is $100 billion for the poor countries to buy clean energy and adapt to the more frequent and more volatile temperature extremes, which are going to be virtually certain, according to a brand new report from the climate scientists. So those are some of the potential deliverables, as they say.
Yeah, potential being the key word there. What if the politicians can't agree on anything, though, what's really happening? I mean, what are the people who do this stuff for a living say?
Well, let's take the International Energy Agency. You know, they're widely recognized as some of the best in the business on energy and projections, and they gave their latest forecast today. And the IEA says the way the world is burning oil and gas and coal, it's on track to heat up 6 degrees Celsius in the long run. Now, that's more than 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
Frame that for me. Is that a lot?
Well, okay. 2 degrees Celsius is what the UN wants to limit it to. They say beyond 2 degrees, unbelievable, catastrophic things are going to happen in the world.
Okay.
But IEA economist Fatih Birol today, he says we're almost locked into 2 degrees already. As he tells it, it's like you're on a carbon diet.
You eat a very good Turkish baklava, and you have already 80% of your calories are eaten up. Only 20% for the rest of the day. or for the next 25 years.
That's a great line.
Really humor from the gallows, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in case you need another reason to be pessimistic, the world last year, it spewed more CO2 than any other year ever. And that puts us on a path to blow past the climate scientists acknowledged worst-case scenario from a few years back, Kai.
So what is there to be hopeful about, if anything? I mean, because a lot of people are working really hard on this, right?
Well, and a lot of investors are. If you're a proponent of clean tech, big bets are still being made out there. By one estimate, it's a $250 billion market today, on its way to almost double by 2020. You know, cars are getting more efficient, solar and wind are getting more competitive. The interesting thing is the bankers at HSBC, they think emerging economies will lead this. That is, countries like Korea and, of course, China think low carbon is not a job-killing, hold-your-nose future, but rather the next big thing, and they want to get there first.
Scott Tong at our sustainability desk. Scott, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
It's not just me I'm shopping for here, you know. My kid needs a new pair of running shoes. Nikes, probably, size 8, if I remember. There's Christmas. I have no idea what I'm getting my wife. Forget my company's lost productivity. APM, schmapm, it's me. Helping the economic recovery, right? One place I haven't been able to find a bargain online today has been the Apple website. iPads and iPhones, full price only. Thank you very much. Most of Apple's best-selling stuff is made overseas, China mainly. But if you go looking for the Apple logo on a factory over there, it's just not going to happen. The company's as secretive about its suppliers as it is about everything else. In fact, that's the root of all its secrecy. But it's been getting harder for Apple to keep everything it does under wraps. There are real and growing concerns about environmental problems at Chinese factories thought to be working with Apple. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz has that story.
The story begins with a factory just outside of Shanghai. It's 3 football fields long, it's blue and gray, and it's owned by the Taiwanese company Kaidar Electronics. In August, environmental groups released a report saying Kaidar's factory was emitting toxic levels of pollution. The report also said the company was making products for Apple, which is notorious for keeping its supply chain secret. The report said the pollution was so bad that it was making people in a nearby village sick. So I went there. The streets of Tongxin Village are lined with garbage. The air carries a strong chemical smell like WD-40. When I arrived, people were eager to tell me about the pollution.
The fumes make my family dizzy. It's hard to walk outside sometimes because of the smell.
A 15-foot wall is the only thing separating Kaidar's factory from Bao Shuiping's front door. Tongxin didn't used to be like this. For decades, it was a quiet farming village with a creek meandering through it. Then 10 years ago, one factory after another was built until the village was completely surrounded. Neither Kaidar nor Apple would talk about the factory. Behind the scenes, though, Apple met with environmentalists like Ma Jun, one of the authors of the pollution report and one of China's best-known activists. Apple's supply chain managers told Ma the company audited nearly a dozen of its suppliers. They showed him a PowerPoint presentation of their findings, improper wastewater treatment, bad hazardous storage practices, things like that. But
they used one slide to explain this.
One slide. That's it. And Apple wouldn't identify which suppliers were polluting.
If they don't want to let the public know who their suppliers are, they should at least encourage, you know, or require the suppliers with violation records to come up and disclose their own problems to the public by themselves.
Ma says he understands the need to keep suppliers in China secret, especially given the country's notorious reputation for stealing technology. But according to supply chain expert Matthew Davis, there's a bigger reason.
By keeping the information of their supply chain secret, they've created almost a brand lust.
Davis says secrecy is what's behind the magic, the showmanship, and the hype of an Apple product launch.
In brand lust, the products themselves are so talked about and so publicized that it generates a lot of activity, and they have these huge product announcements.
The flip side to Apple secrecy, though, is that nobody can tell how much its suppliers are damaging the environment when they make iPhones and iPads. Nobody, that is, except Apple. But now there's someone else, the deputy director of the Environmental Protection Bureau of Kunshan. That's the city that has jurisdiction over the Kaidar factory. Earlier this month, Ding Yudong spoke to state-run television in China about the harmful chemicals emitted from that factory. So we called Ding to find out more. And that's when he told Marketplace what Apple's been keeping secret for months. The Kaidar factory is making Apple products, and it's broken environmental law in the process. Ding says last month his bureau shut down 10 production lines at Kaidar's factory. Lines, he said, that were spraying a chemical coating onto Apple products and products for other companies, too. He said the chemical spray was harmful to the people living nearby. When we approached Apple, the company again refused to confirm whether the Kaidar factory makes its products. I recently returned to Tongxin Village to see if things had changed since Kaidar shut down the production lines. This time, nobody wanted to talk to me. Some people hid in their homes when they saw me. When I ask two men about the pollution, they say, "What pollution? There's no pollution here." Another man says he and others who spoke to journalists have been threatened. He angrily accused me of working for Apple. I ask one woman if she's been threatened. I don't know, she says nervously. But then Dong Chaojen invites me inside her house.
Yes, we've been threatened. Village officials have warned us not to talk to reporters about the pollution.
But what about the pollution? Dong says the air is better during the day, but each night, the Kaidar factory, the one where some of Apple's products are made, it starts to stink up the village air, just like it did before. Environmentalist Ma Jun says he hopes Apple will clean up its supply chain. Apple's a big brand, and Ma knows if he goes after the company, it could have a big impact on many Chinese companies that regularly pollute.
We decided that we need to put pressure through the brands to reach them.
And even though Apple's still being secretive about its Chinese suppliers, it's becoming clear to Ma that Apple's already begun to put pressure on its extensive supply chain in China. In Tongxin Village, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, yeah, you know, never mind. I got too much shopping to do. All right, no, seriously, I've been working all day, I promise. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow bounced 291 points higher, better than 2.5%. The NASDAQ shot up 85 points, 3.5%. The S&P 500 rebounded 33 points, just shy of 3%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Gina Delvac, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Coming up next time, back here, charitable giving, Freakonomics style.
So now I'm going publicly and outing these people and at least embarrassing them.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.